The primary thrust of Christ's message was that eschatology is essentially ethical and only secondarily predictive. Eschatology is revealed to provoke God's people to uphold their responsibilities, to faithfully carry out the Great Commission, to diligently build up the church, to pray without ceasing, to engage in spiritual warfare, to serve the hurting and the innocent, to walk in holiness, and to live in faith, hope, and love.
We're going to be discussing anything and everything that you'll be facing in the world today after the sermon. My name is Jeremy Lundmark, and you're listening to episode number 48. That opening sermon clip comes from George Grant. It was shared to me by Chris Ragsdale in the Tech Reformation Slack. And it goes back to some of the roots that I had originally set up with this podcast, that I wanted to have opening sermon clips and introductory material that would come from you, the listener. And I never got a whole lot of feedback on that, but it's something that I want to look back to and try to do. As we get to episode number 50, I'm going to be going back through some of the evolution of After the Sermon and some of the ideas that I dropped. And actually, that was one of the great ideas that I had that I never really got to employ, using some of your pastor's sermon clips to be the introduction for my episode. So I want to say a big thank you to Chris Ragsdale for sharing that George Grant clip, and would encourage you to check out that full sermon. I'll have a link to the full sermon in the show notes. And listen, if you have a great clip, a great quote from your pastor, be sure to share that clip with me, and also get me the link directly to the full sermon so I can share them as opening quotes for after the sermon, and then direct people to your pastor's sermon. The whole goal of this podcast initially was to be definitely secondary to the sermon, but also a supplement to the sermon to say, hey, what do I do once I've heard the preaching? How do I live and walk in this world? And so that's been the goal. We want to, in everything that we do, magnify the work of those godly pastors who are proclaiming the truth of God's word every single week. And we want to challenge you to put those sermons into application. So again, thanks to Chris Ragsdale for getting me back to those roots. I appreciate the help with that. And a great quote from a great sermon there from George Grant. We have had some excellent interviews over the last three episodes. And in this particular episode, I'm going to try to catch up on some of the things that I have been unable to address because of those fantastic interviews. And I do want to say a huge thank you to Calvinist Vader, Calvinist Cicero, and the Sarcastic Missionary for some excellent interviews over the last 3 weeks. If you've skipped over those because of the length, or you just didn't have time to get to them, listen, we had some excellent conversations with the Sarcastic Missionary. We talked about everything missions related, how you can truly support your missionaries. With Calvinist Cicero, we talked about everything that has to do with manhood, masculinity, a little bit of millennials in that episode. And then last week's episode, episode 47, we had a fantastic conversation with Calvinist Darth Vader, talking just about divorce, remarriage, and all the challenges associated with that, and the importance of being connected to your local church when your marriage faces those difficult times. And so I think if you just take the time to listen to those three episodes, you will be truly blessed, and I think your marriage will be blessed. I think your walk with Christ will be challenged a little bit by episode number 46, where we talked about masculinity. And after conducting and being a part of the interview with the sarcastic missionary. I think missionaries and those who support missions on the field overseas could really be blessed, challenged, and encouraged with that episode. So I just encourage you to go back and listen to those. But for this episode, we want to get into our appetizers like we typically do. And I want to start off with something that's a little bit dated at this point, but I still wanted to touch on it because it's actually something I've discussed in the past. And I wanted to come back to that conversation and sort of refer you to the conversation I had in that episode. Now, what I'm referring to is the Harambe the Gorilla incident. And for those who have been kind of under a rock, you may have missed this, but there was at one of the, I believe it was a Cleveland Zoo. I can't remember which zoo it was. Maybe I've got Cleveland on my mind because they just won the NBA championship last night. I'm not sure why. But the Harambe the Gorilla was a gorilla in a zoo that had been around for over 100 years, and they've never had an incident like this. But a 3 or 4 year old, the reports that I read were 3 year old, but I heard a lot of people talking about the child being 4 years old. Somehow a child got into the gorilla's cage, and Harambe was, if you watch the videos, it looks like he's protecting the child, but the child was in serious danger. You've got a 300-500 pound gorilla literally dragging this child through the water, a little creek that was down there. And ultimately, the zookeepers, the people who run the zoo, made the decision to kill the gorilla. And obviously, there was an outrage from the left, a lot of frustration at, oh, this beautiful animal being killed, and they could have tranquilized it, and all these arguments that were thrown out there. And what I wanted to do was, I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this because I think for my listeners, this is something that is obvious. Obviously, human life is more valuable than animal life. But at the same time, I'd encourage you to go back and listen to episode number 6, where I talked about Cecil the Lion. And for those of you who don't follow these news stories, Cecil the Lion was a lion who was shot and was a protected animal. And the hunter who shot him was an American who was out doing one of these excursions where he's, you know, sort of guided, and there's a lion you can shoot, and he shoots it. And he didn't realize that Cecil the Lion was, I believe it was some sort of a tribal animal, or they really looked up to this animal, and there was a huge outrage from it. But what I tried to do in that episode was sort of balance this reality that, yes, there is a place, scripturally speaking, for love for animals and for caring for the things of this world. And there's a reality in Genesis, for example, that Adam was called to take care of the land and to name the animals and to make them personal and give them descriptors. And throughout the Bible, we actually have evidence of people showing ownership of animals. And there's a great example with David where Nathan and David are having this conversation, and Nathan uses this story about this guy who had one poor little ewe lamb. And a rich man comes who has all kinds of lambs, and he takes it, slaughters it, and kills it. And David is outraged. I talk a lot about that in my Cecil the Lion episode, and I think it applies here. There's a certain amount of justifiable frustration that comes with the loss of an animal, and there's certainly a place biblically for personalizing animals and loving animals. But at the same time, when compared to, and this is a perfect picture of it, I know in my Cecil the Lion episode, I was kind of frustrated because, hey, here this lion died and we have abortion happening. Well, this is a perfect example of the left missing the point, putting value on an animal greater than that of a human being. And it's a perfect example of it. And just for this appetizer, I wanted to direct you to episode number 6, where I talk about Cecil the Lion. I think you'll be encouraged and challenged by that, because I know whenever something like this happens, I know there's another story circulating right now. I don't know any details about it, but there was an alligator, I guess, at Disney or something like that. It was a tragic event there. Again, I haven't looked that up. But again, whenever there's this animal-human life dilemma, it seems like you've got people on the right who are like, animals don't matter. And then you've got people on the left who are like, oh, who cares? The animals are precious and special and defenseless, et cetera, et cetera. And there actually is a middle ground that the Bible calls us to. There is a certain amount of respect and love and care and compassion that we can have and ought to have for the creation that God has given us. But at the same time, at no point within Scripture is that life expected to raise above the value of what God has done in his creation with humankind in putting in us the imago Dei, in breathing into us the breath of life, and especially formulating us in his own image. That is something that he has done specially to us as humans. And we just know by looking at animal the animal kingdom versus humans, that God has done something special, and we should recognize that. And in a situation like this, placing the value of the child above the value of the animal ought to be a no-brainer. And of course, it was the right decision by the zookeepers to do that. I apologize, this is an appetizer. I don't know which zoo it was. But just as these issues arise, I always want to be reminded that our tendency to push away the liberal left and say, oh, these animals don't matter, that may be an extreme view. And we have to be careful not to, in our defense of human life and our frustration with issues like abortion, not to go to the extreme of saying, oh, animal life doesn't matter. That's not true. And the Bible doesn't teach us that either. But we have to be careful in the way that we apply these truths, that we're balanced in our approach, so that we're not just nitpicking, cherry picking, so to speak, our favorite issues, but we're actually being biblical on all of these fronts. And that's going to be important when we get to our main topic today, which has to do with guns and violence and the shooting that happened in Orlando, the tragic shooting that happened there. But before I get to that, I want to do a quick appetizer, just referring all of you to a two-part interview that I did with Owen Pond with the Ask a Millennial Christian podcast. He and I had a great conversation about technology, millennials in the workforce, and the challenges that both baby boomers, Gen Xers, and millennials have in relating to one another with technology advancing, but a lot of the established organizations being built around older principles, and how sometimes those principles aren't as fast as the technology around us, and how job security and issues like 9/11 and the 2008 housing crisis, how that has maybe contributed to a fear or a desire on the older generation's part to maintain jobs, while at the same time blocking gifts and talents that millennials have that they simply don't, and just sort of how that dynamic plays itself out. I mean, we had a great conversation. I think the two episodes together are like 90 minutes. It might be a little more than that, but highly encourage you to check that out. My two-part interview with Owen Pond on the Ask a Millennial Christian podcast. Be sure to check that out. Now, before we get to part two of our Best Candidate series, I started this about 3-4 weeks ago. We did the Best Candidate on abortion. Today, we're going to do our Best Candidate on the Second Amendment. But before I do that, I want to share an advertisement for a great podcast that I want you to check out, part of the Theology Mix Podcast Network, The Sinner's League, with Calvinist Colson and Calvinist Lex Lutheran.
Lost people don't think in terms of, God have mercy on me, a sinner.
No, they don't. Sinner's League. That's like the perfect promo drop right there. A league of the guilty, only righteous in Christ. Welcome to The Sinner's League, hosted by Calvinist Colson and yours truly, Lex Lutheran. Two lay people, two brothers in Christ, bantering theology from a real-world perspective. On our podcasts and on blogs hosted by Theology Mix.
I would highly encourage you to check out that podcast. I'm actually going to be having Lex Lutheran on the podcast, hopefully in a couple of weeks. We have some great ideas of things we're going to discuss, and I've had Calvinist Colson on the show twice before. I encourage you to check him out both on that program and on our episodes here on After the Sermon. But let's get into our next appetizer, which is sort of part two of my Best Candidate series. Now that we're narrowing the candidates down to what I consider to be the top five most viable candidates, we have the opportunity now to evaluate them on different issues. And if you go back to, I think it's episode 44, you can listen to my conversation on the best candidate on abortion. And today we're going to talk about the best candidate on the Second Amendment. Also, I'm going to be trying to write correlating posts for TheologyMix.com. I am a contributing author there, and I'm going to try to put these into text form as well, so you can look those up there and sort of review them all after I've completed this entire series. But today we want to look at the Second Amendment, especially in light of the Orlando shooting. And when we get to our main topic, we're going to get very specific with the issue that happened in Orlando with a Islamic terrorist, or at least a man claiming to be an Islamic terrorist, had aligned himself with ISIS and went and shot. It looks like they are counting it as 49 dead in a gay nightclub. So A very sad and tragic situation that happened a little over a week ago, but it brings to light this issue of the Second Amendment, and it's actually put the candidates in a very interesting position to actually expose themselves as to where they stand and how they view this whole situation and how they would seek to, as president, fix the problem, or what would their solution be. And as I did in the past, I want to continue by starting with the worst candidate in my view. And again, if you take the exact opposite position of me, you're going to just reverse this and go, wait, I actually support that, so I'll make this the best candidate. But I think most of my listeners will at least agree on some level. But the worst candidate in terms of protecting and defending the Second Amendment, in my opinion, is Mrs. Hillary Clinton. And the reason for that is she has come out strong, not so much against the Second Amendment, but the conversation is now circulating around lists and what types of lists should we have and what kinds of lists should we use to restrict people's ability to purchase guns and what kinds of guns can we have and should we not even have access to. Hillary Clinton is on the forefront of this, and she has made it very clear. If you go to her website, you will see that she wants to have a list for criminals, the mentally unstable, domestic abusers, terrorists. I mean, the list is pretty wide, and she wants to basically restrict gun ownership for anybody who falls into a variety of categories. And I'll just state up front that in terms of restricting our ability and our access to guns in order to exercise our Second Amendment right, Hillary Clinton is the worst. And I say the worst in that she is restricting that the greatest, or has every intention of restricting that right to the greatest possible level. Now, the problem with that is, and there are some people who would disagree with me and say, well, wait, wouldn't that make everything safer? When we get to our main topic and we talk about the Orlando shooting, we're going to talk about what makes us safer. But if you look at the world and you go, less guns means a safer world, then by all means, you're going to say, well, Hillary Clinton's a great candidate. But for me personally, and somebody who leans libertarian in his views, I believe and I maintain that the best defense against a criminal with a gun is a good person with a gun. And I'll defend that a little bit later in our episode. But as it relates to defending the Second Amendment, there's one person who I think tops the list in terms of the one who wants to restrict that right the most. And Hillary Clinton is that person. Now, I've been having a really hard time nailing down Jill Stein on this issue and some other issues because she likes to use her platform of a universal healthcare system to sort of answer and redirect just about any question. And in her view, it seems like she wants to see less guns out there. And she actually makes a very good point, I think, in that she believes that her single-payer, healthcare-for-all social system would provide mental care that would not only keep guns out of the hands of mentally unstable people, but it would actually care for the mentally unstable people such that they wouldn't use the guns in a violent manner. Now, the problem with that is, number one, at least me personally, I'm not all for a single-payer healthcare system, but number two, again, you have this desire to limit and restrict the ability of law-abiding citizens of the United States of America to protect themselves. And ultimately, the issue comes down to whether you're talking about a terror list or a list for the mentally unstable, you're talking about a list that can be manipulated by the government to restrict guns from anybody. For example, who's to say that if we said, you know what, we need a list that puts people who are extremely religious, and our target at this time is Muslims, Islamic extremists. We want to keep them from having weapons. Who's to say in 4 to 10 to 15 years, somebody's not going to come along and go, well, what about those fundamentalist Christians? And how easy is it to get on a Christian watch list and a Mormon watch list? And you start to get down this track where you begin to restrict law-abiding citizens from exercising their Second Amendment right. And the same goes for the mentally unstable. There seems to be a very strong case for keeping weapons out of the hands of the mentally unstable. Well, while that may be a good argument and it may have some validity to it, again, the question is, how do we manage this list so that somebody doesn't come along and say, well, a homosexual is mentally unstable? There was a time when that was considered a mental disease. Not anymore, of course. But what about the religious? So somebody who's extremely religious, whether they're Christian or Muslim or whatever, that person is mentally unstable. That's actually a mental disease. How hard is it to get there? And that's the problem with these lists. It can be twisted and used against law-abiding citizens to keep them from exercising their Second Amendment rights. And once the government gets its hands on the power to do something, it inevitably uses it against law-abiding citizens. It's just always been the case. And the only way we can keep that from happening is by avoiding these lists. And so Stein doesn't go out of her way to say necessarily who shouldn't get a gun. She definitely is clear that she wants to see less guns and then diverts her attention to her single-payer health system, and somehow that would solve the problem. Coming in at number three, working our way back from 5, 4, 3, I put Donald Trump. And I have to be clear here, I had a hard time placing Donald Trump in third and Gary Johnson in second, because the only difference between them is the type of list that they prefer. In Donald Trump's case, he supports that anybody who is on the no-fly list should also be on the no-gun list, that somehow this terror watch list should have a mirroring effect on who should be able to get a gun, and if you're on the terror watch list, you can't get a gun. And again, that may sound super reasonable to some of you, and that's fine. But at the same time, how can the government use this list then in order to manipulate the system? And that's the question that I think a lot of us look down the road and go, that makes me a little bit uncomfortable, giving the government that authority. Now, on the flip side, you've got Governor Gary Johnson, who is against a terror watch list or a no-fly, no-gun list. He definitely doesn't support that. And he is a big supporter of the Second Amendment. But at the same time, he would prefer a list for the mentally unstable and mentally ill. In fact, in the Libertarian debate, the one that was on Stossel on Fox Business Network, his strongest challenger, Austin Peterson, challenged him on this, and in a very strong way. And again, it's a matter of who or what type of list we're going to have and how are we going to manage that list. And the fact that we're unclear on that shows that you've got people who are willing to restrict the ability of law-abiding citizens to protect themselves through the use of the Second Amendment. Now, just in order to give a little bit of support for Donald Trump in this area, I want to share a quick clip from him. I'm going to share a clip from Daryl Castle as well. But I want to share with you from Donald Trump his support of the Second Amendment.
So important is our Second Amendment. The politicians are chipping away at it day by day, night by night. It gets weaker and weaker. We're not going to let it happen. We are going to protect our Second Amendment. If I'm president, you can count on it 100%.
So while Donald Trump is strong in saying he wants to have some type of a list that would restrict those who can have access to weapons, he's also a strong supporter of the Second Amendment. I wasn't able to find a specific clip for Governor Gary Johnson on this issue, but you can read on his website. He's definitely for a support of guns and gun rights and gun owners. But there is this little caveat, just like with Donald Trump, that where Donald Trump wants to have the list for religious extremists and terrorism, you've got Gary Johnson, who wants to have some kind of a list for those who might be considered mentally unstable. And coming in first, at least for me, in terms of protecting our Second Amendment rights, is Daryl Castle of the Constitution Party. I want to share a clip from his Castle report that talks about the importance of protecting the American citizens' right to protect themselves. Here's a clip from Daryl Castle's Castle report.
Disarmed people are defeated people. Just as a defeated army stacks its arms in front of the victorious general. Armed people are free because they have the means of resistance in their hands. The American colonists were threatened with disarmament by the British Army, and they rose to rebellion. Defense of oneself and one's family is everybody's responsibility. The government cannot and will not do this for you. The all-knowing, all-powerful state, which of course is run totally by good people, wants a disarmed, defeated people under surveillance every second of every day, with every penny earned and every penny spent all recorded for their inspection. We as a free people have to debunk the lies that undermine this status approach to life and to living. Remember that self-defense is a basic human right. Don't believe the state's lies. At least that's the way I see it. Until next time, folks, this is Daryl Castle. Thanks for listening.
Now, in case you missed that, what Daryl Castle is saying is that people who do not have the right to defend themselves are a defeated people. And if we continue to give up our ability to protect and defend ourselves, which is, as he says, each individual person's right of themselves. It's our job to protect ourselves. It's not the government's job. And whenever we look at these issues in terms of whether it's managing the family with Planned Parenthood or defending ourselves or whatever the issue may be, a lot of times you see people looking to the government to do what we as individuals, as free Americans, are supposed to be responsible for doing ourselves. And as it relates to the Second Amendment, if we're responsible to defending ourselves, even defending ourselves against a government that might overreach its authority, the only way we can do that is if we have the ability to take up arms and protect ourselves. And as Daryl Castle says, a disarmed people is a defeated people. We have no leverage whatsoever against an overreaching government if we are unable to arm ourselves. And so as it relates to the Second Amendment and in terms of protecting the Second Amendment rights, I put my list in this order. Daryl Castle coming in first, who, as far as I can tell, does not support any type of list that would restrict gun ownership. Then Gary Johnson and Donald Trump almost on an even keel because they both support Second Amendment rights, but at the same time, they support a different type of list that would restrict some gun ownership that could ultimately be used to keep law-abiding citizens from accessing a means by which to defend themselves. Then I have Jill Stein in fourth and Hillary Clinton coming in fifth, who wants to have not only one list, but a variety of lists and people on that list. Now, before we get into our main topic, I want to highlight a new podcast that's been brought into the Theology Mix Podcast Network, Hope for the Journey. I'm looking forward to having one of the hosts on the show a little bit later next month to talk about drug addiction and the challenges related to that. But here is a little bit of a promo for the Hope for the Journey podcast.
Leaving the 99 in search of the one. This is Kevin with the Hope for the Journey podcast, and we have a message for you. You are not alone. Whether you're a parent or a pastor, if you're dealing with a prodigal, you are not alone. Join Nick, David, and I as each week we discuss those feelings you're feeling, the fear, the doubt, the guilt, the questions, the temptation not to ask for prayer this week because you've asked every week beforehand and you're starting to feel needy, and the begging God, I believe, but help my unbelief. Whether it's discussing my personal journey parenting a child with drug addiction or pastors we interview who are doing creative ministry to the prodigals in the far country, we try to discuss this difficult topic with a little bit of levity and a lot of hope, giving parents hope for their journey and encouraging churches to remind people that he is faithful. When the whole earth shakes and the mountains
break, I won't be afraid because you are faithful. Now I want to turn to our main topic, and our main topic is a little bit of a somber one because it's discussing the Orlando shooting, which took place a little over a week ago, where 49 were killed and I think over 50 were injured. And before I get into talking about this topic, I want to do what most people who comment on this do and just let the friends and families know who were connected to this shooting, those who lost loved ones, those who were injured, those who had loved ones who were injured. I want you to know that our hearts and our prayers go out to you. And I know that for many Christians, it's a difficult thing to say that because the situation is one where there's a lifestyle involved and connected to the shooting that we may or may not agree with. But at the same time, as believers in Christ, we ought to be able to recognize the image of God on all men. And as much as I talked about the beginning of this episode, we should be at least have a genuine sorrow for the loss of animal life, all the more we should have a sincere and genuine mourning and sorrow whenever human life is taken. And if we're seriously going to be defenders of life, regardless of what that life is or what that life participates in, we ought to be on some level saddened that it was taken and taken in the way that it was just a couple of weeks ago. Now, I do want to take a moment and give a brief moment of silence for those victims of that shooting, and then I want to get a little bit into the conversation about what can we do and what's behind these shootings. Now, as I thought about this this tragic shooting, I thought to myself, there's people who are going to come out and talk about this, and they're going to talk about it from a couple different angles. You have different types of responses that emerge. Of course, the right is going to come out and blame gun-free zones, unarmed citizens, and in the case of Donald Trump, also the Islamic terrorist extremist. And all of those things are, there's certainly a case to be had there. And of course, the left is going to come out as it has, and it's going to say that the problem is the guns or the hate or the anger, and they're going to target that. And so what I wanted to do before I actually get into what I believe is behind the shootings in general, not necessarily the Orlando shooting specifically, but mass shootings in general, I wanted to share just a little bit of one of the arguments that I heard that I thought was just kind of silly, but at the same time demonstrates the faultiness of the left's view that less guns makes for a safer place. And here's a clip from Trevor Noah of The Daily Show. And for those who don't know, this is a comedy news show where it sort of makes fun of politics and issues in the media. And to be fair, I just want to be completely open here. I did cut this down, and Trevor did a great job of remembering and honoring those victims. I cut that out. We've already gone ahead and we've done the remembrance part of it. And just for brevity's sake, I want you to hear the part of the argument that I want to address. And here it is from Trevor Noah.
We shouldn't allow this to be normal. It's not a normal thing. It's like milk from Almonds or sushi from Walgreens. It's not normal, people. What's also not normal is having the same thing happen to us over and over and over again and doing nothing to change it. That's not normal. You know, when I was a kid, I never used to tie my shoelaces because I was an idiot, right? And now, obviously, I'm an adult. I'm still an idiot, but I'm an adult. And so I only wear Velcro. But what I would do as a child is I would run around, I would trip on my shoelaces, I'd fall down, I'd cry, I'd be like, oh, mommy, 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 mommy. And my mom would come over and she said to me, get up, Trevor, get up, get up. What happened? And I said, I fell down. And she'd be like, why did you fall? Why did you fall? I said, because I tripped. And she's like, why did you trip? And she goes, your shoelaces. And I said, it's my shoelaces. And we'd realize I fell because of the shoelaces. I'll tie them and then move on. I knew I had to move on, but I had to tie the shoelaces first. I had to change something. I mean, I could have said to my mom, Mom, why are you bringing shoelaces into this conversation? Why are you blaming the shoelaces for something the sidewalk did to my knees? Who even says there's a connection between untied shoelaces and falling anyway? You're violating my right to keep my shoelaces untied. I didn't say that. I didn't say that. You know why? Because I realized after falling a lot, there was a connection between my shoelaces being untied and getting hurt.
Now, let me give credit where credit is due. Trevor Noah is responding in a way that I would expect people to respond, frustrated that this happens, and he's absolutely right that something needs to change. And what needs to change is where it gets a little confusing. And both President Obama, along with Hillary Clinton and Trevor Noah in this clip, they all focused on the need to restrict guns. And what's fascinating about this, and this illustration perfectly demonstrates the faultiness and the error of the logic and the reasoning. Trevor Noah uses this example of shoelaces and how shoelaces were leading to him falling, but specifically untied shoelaces. And the problem is that not that he needs to get rid of shoelaces altogether, but that he needs to use them in a way that is appropriate. What's interesting to me is that somebody who is an advocate of restricting weapon use uses this illustration, and his solution is not no more shoelaces, but to tie the shoelaces. And if you use that line of reasoning, then what is the solution to the gun problem? It's proper use of guns, just like the proper use of shoelaces will lead you to stop falling. And so basically you have not a defense for gun control or shoelace control, if you will, but you have a defense for the proper use and execution of guns. And that leads us to a bigger question. What is the proper use of guns? Why do they exist? Why do we need them? Why do we have them? Well, here's the reality. Mankind, by and large, is an evil people. The Bible teaches us that man is inherently wicked, and we are constantly going to be doing two things. One, developing things that will allow us to be more evil, and number two, those of us who have a little bit of goodness in us and a sense of righteousness that's been built in us through the Imago Dei, through that image of God that we talked about earlier in this episode, we're going to be developing weapons on the same level and resources to stop that evil. And there's this constant battle between good and evil in our world, and such that you can't blame the gun for the evil. I love the illustration that Dave Ramsey uses in his Financial Peace University. He talks about how money isn't evil, and he uses the illustration of a brick. A brick can be used to smash a window or build an orphanage. And guns are the same way. The reason we need guns and we ought to have guns and we ought to probably use guns is because there are bad people out there who are going to do the types of things that happened in Orlando. And the only way to keep those things from happening is to ensure that law-abiding, good, properly trained citizens have access to those same weapons. The answer is not no more shoelaces. The answer is properly tied shoelaces. And so in that sense, I actually agree with Trevor Noah, except his solution isn't properly tied shoelaces, but no shoelaces at all, or only shoelaces for certain types of people. But that's not the best solution. And as I started thinking about his response, President Obama's response, and Donald Trump's response, I mean, Donald Trump, by the way, I just want to give him some props where they're due, has done a great job of reaching out to the homosexual community and saying, hey, and his support of the Second Amendment and saying, hey, you know, the people in that nightclub should have had access to weaponry. And he sort of obliterated this this liberal wall that was put up between, you know, the homosexual community and Republicans. And he said, look, the Second Amendment, which we hold dear and we fight for, helps you. And so he's really done a great job leveraging this and showing his love and care for the homosexual community without necessarily embracing their lifestyle or approving it, but just saying, look, there's another issue here, and that issue is the protection of the Second Amendment. And what I was thinking about as I was thinking about this whole issue of the Second Amendment and guns and the shooting in Orlando, I thought, you know, the problem, it's not guns. And I think that's pretty obvious. And the problem is not religion. And one of the things that's kind of come out is that we want to target ISIS and ISIL, and we want to go after Islamic extremism. But at the heart and the core of it, as much as that played a factor, and it has, I'm not denying that, religion is not what's to blame. And another thing that gets blamed is hatred. Without question, because it was an act done against the homosexual community, you had people coming out and saying, end the hate, no more hate, no hate, you know, the N-O-H, the number 8, and we have to end the hate. But did you see, there's this misunderstanding of what is right and what is wrong in our world. And at the end of the day, the problem that we have in our society, particularly in the United States of America, it's not a religion problem or a gun problem or even a hatred problem. It's a problem of twisted and warped morality. That's the problem. We don't have the right compass to take appropriate action in situations like this. And let me just give you some examples. Let's take this whole idea that we should not hate into account. Let's consider this. And I know I'm going to get in trouble for this, but if you're biblical, this isn't a problem for you. Hate is not a bad emotion. But in the United States of America, any type of anger or expression of anger or expression of hate or outburst of anger, that's considered wrong. Even if that hatred is geared toward that which is right to go against. And what this produces, it produces sort of a weakness in us, such that when we look at this guy who shot up the Orlando nightclub, we look at it and go, well, why didn't anybody stand up and shoot back? And my understanding, by the way, is that there was a security guard who might have been there. And some of the people on the left are saying, well, see, another guy with a gun didn't help. Well, another couple more guys would have helped, but we don't want to get into that too much. But the point is this. When he was probably shooting, he was probably shooting with this philosophical idea that it's wrong to kill. And so he's probably aiming for the leg or the arm or trying to incapacitate the person. Because there's this built into our society, this false view that to take any life is wrong. But there are times, there are just moments when it's right to take a life. And in this moment, as we mourn the loss of good American people, innocent Americans, as it's pertaining to our laws, okay? I'm not talking biblically here because I understand that they were all under sin and all of that, guilty under the commands of God. We all are. But in terms of innocent Americans who had broken no laws in terms of our state and our nation, these people, their lives were cut short for no reason at all. And that ought to anger us. We ought to hate that. But in our culture, we have this theory that, oh, we have to end the hate and stop the hate. But the problem is there's an appropriate position for hatred. And there's an appropriate place for anger. And there's an appropriate place for guns. And there's an appropriate place for religion. And so my point is this. The problem in our society is not guns or religion or hatred. The problem is we have a warped sense of how we are to employ these things. And that warped sense comes as a result of our sin nature. We have gone overboard in our belief in some things, and we've gone under the level that we should have gone in other things. As it pertains, for example, to the shooter, somebody should have stopped him, incapacitated him, dare I say, killed him, in order to stop this mass shooting from occurring. But where were those people? You see, we've said guns are bad. Guns are the problem. And so those people who might have been able to get a gun probably didn't do it because the state wouldn't allow it, or they had this moral sense because of society's pressure that to take a life is wrong, or to hate somebody is wrong, or to be angry is wrong. And so they applied that, and it produced what Daryl Castle talked about in our clip earlier, a defenseless person, a defenseless people. What we need in our culture is a righting, a correcting of our warped view of morality, and it's going to have to start with our sense of justice. Now, the problem is, where are we going to get that justice from? You see, in our culture, when something like this happens, we blame the gun, the religion, and the emotion. If we convince society that the guns are bad and they don't have guns, and then we convince them that the emotion is wrong, and so they don't react appropriately in these situations, and then we take away the one source where they could get the right sense of justice and morality, which would be religion. And listen, I'm speaking generally here. This is not I'm not trying to be an apologetic here at this point in defending Christianity, because I'm sure if I did that, people would get offended. But when you start to strike down the sources of defense, you create a defenseless people. You create a defenseless philosophy that opens itself up to these things. And listen, another thing people blame is gun-free zones. But again, the underlying philosophy there is that guns are bad. Religion is bad. Extreme religious belief is bad. Hatred is bad. So now we have no sense of justice, no tools in which to inflict justice, and no emotion from which to find the courage and the strength to take those stands. And the more I think about this, the more I realize that we're seeing two very important scriptural passages play out. Let me read them for you. The first is Amos 5:15, which says this: "Hate evil and love good, and establish justice in the gate. It may be that the Lord, the God of hosts, will be gracious to the remnant of Joseph." Now, this is specifically written to a particular tribe and a people, but understand what it's saying. Hate evil and love good. We're supposed to have an emotion, an appropriate emotion that our culture has all but eliminated. No hate. That's what the homosexual community wants us to believe. That's what the liberal left wants us to believe. There shouldn't be any hate. But what do we learn? What is that famous quote? I forget who says it, but all evil needs to prevail is for good men to do nothing. If we are going to embrace this notion that all hatred is bad, we're not going to hate the right things. We're not going to respond appropriately in an event like this, which happened in Orlando. And on the flip side, it says love good. And here's what we have to understand in our society. We have to come to the place where we get this, that justice is a good thing, that hating the right things is good, and loving the good things is good. But you see, what we've done is we've hated good things. Let me tell you what is a good thing, and this is going to surprise probably some listeners. Guns are good. They have the ability to be used as tools that are for God's good. Think about World War II. Think about Hitler. Think about what guns and weaponry allowed us to stop. Think about that. Think about the good that these weapons can be used for and must be used for by those who believe in justice and those who hold to morality and those who hold to courage and strength and honor. We talked about loving and protecting animal life and loving and protecting human life, but the only way we do that is that we first affirm that that type of protection and an appropriate courage, emotion, hatred for the maligning of that life is good. if we don't have that, if that emotion doesn't build up, we will lack the courage to stand and we will become victims. Not only victims emotionally, but victims in terms of the tools that we have to us. And what we've done in our culture is we have loved what is not good. And what we've loved, for example, is this notion that guns are bad. What we've loved is this idea that the emotion of hatred and anger are bad. And in so doing, we've actually loved what is evil. And that brings me to the second passage, which comes from Micah chapter 3. I'll read verses 1 and 2. It says, "And I said, Hear, you heads of Jacob and rulers of the house of Israel, is it not for you to know justice, you who hate the good and love the evil?" And you see, this is what's happened in our society. We have created a morality, one that suits us, because our philosophy says what's right for you is right for you and what's right for me is right for me. And we have ignored justice. And in so doing, we have actually hated that which is good. We have said guns are bad. We've hated something that can be used for great good, the emotion of hatred. We've said, oh, you know what? If you hate anything, you're bad. And then somehow I'm supposed to find some other emotion for what happened in Orlando? Let me be very clear about this. The appropriate emotion for what happened in Orlando, regardless of the religion of the person who executed the murders and the death and the violence, or the position of those who were killed, your emotion towards that should not be pity or regret or disappointment. It ought to be hatred. It ought to be not just frustration, but disgust, hatred, such that it causes within you something to rise up. So as Trevor Noah said, you do something about it, but the something you do is not to hate what is good, but to take what is good and use it for what is good. And see what happens when we diminish religion and we diminish the sources of morality and we diminish truth and we diminish the tools for good and we take them out of the hands of good, well-meaning people, moral people, courageous people, honorable people. As we do that, and as we condemn people for certain types of emotions over time, what happens is that whittles down the people from being able to execute justice, from being able to take the appropriate action when things like this occur. And one of the neat things that's actually coming out of this, and I appreciate Donald Trump's stance because I think philosophically it's fantastic, he's saying, look, here we have this principle of self-defense, and we ought to employ it at appropriate times. Now, the danger is always when you're talking about things like guns and hatred and weapons and anger and all of these things, religion is the extreme side of it. And yes, the extreme side is bad, but the neglect of all of these things is just as bad. What we have to find and dig for in our nation are things that used to be staples in our culture and things that we remember as being great about the United States of America. Things like honor, justice, standing up for what's right, hating what is evil. Those things have been diminished in our culture. They've been maligned in our culture such that we no longer have justice anymore because we look at the world and our world is warped. A man uses a gun to kill a gorilla and we're incensed at the man for taking this valuable animal's life. But something like this happens and we have to ask questions about whether or not it's right to use these weapons for law-abiding citizens to have access to these weapons, as if that's the conversation we should be having. Ultimately, what's wrong in America is what's been wrong in America for a long time. She has been building for years, for decades, her own morality, a morality which, in the end, hates that which is actually good and ends up loving what is evil. And in a situation like what happened in Orlando, you see the sad and tragic results of that philosophy. You see people waking up in the most horrific way imaginable to this reality that no hate isn't good, that no guns isn't good, that no religion isn't good. And to love these things, to love the absence of these things, actually produces the very result that you were trying to avoid in the first place. What we actually need in the United States of America is a resurrection of an understanding of what's right, a love of what's right, a love of what's good, and listen to this, a hatred of what's evil, a hatred of what's not right, and an appropriate execution using all the tools imaginable to stop that evil from happening. And unfortunately, because our culture is so offended by religion and so offended by absolute truth, I don't see that coming for our nation. I see more of the same, because we're still arguing about the guns and the religion and the emotion, and we're not talking about the root problem. And the root problem is a warped morality, a warped philosophy, a broken worldview. And the only thing that will fix that is the sovereign mercy and grace of our God using his gospel preached by his people to transform hearts. I see no other way. As much as I love to talk about presidential candidates, and as much as I love to talk about politics, one thing I realize is that it doesn't matter who you vote for, as important as it is to vote, at the end of the day, what our country needs is not a new Congress or a new president, but it needs godly men and women to stand up with the gospel, proclaim that gospel, and see life transformation on an individual level, such that we cease loving what is evil and we start loving what is good. And we cease hating that which is good and, listen, start hating that which is evil. Folks, this concludes episode number 48 of After the Sermon. If you've been challenged or encouraged by anything in this episode, as always, I like to encourage you to share this widely. Be sure to check out my podcast, my two-part episode there with Owen Pawn on the Ask a Millennial Christian podcast. I think you'll be blessed by that. But be sure to share intentionally when you share this episode. This can be a very sensitive topic. There can be some sensitive issues. And if you have people who are going to be offended by this, maybe don't share specifically with them or share graciously. But as I always like to encourage people, when you share and you share intentionally, give people a timestamp. I think that's always helpful. Don't just tag them in it and say, hey, you need to listen to this whole episode. This one's not as long as the ones that we've just had, but still, nevertheless, be gracious to those listeners and give them what they might want to grab a hold of first, what might apply to them, and then let them tinker around with the podcast from there. You might have somebody who's specifically excited about the Second Amendment issues. You might have somebody who needs to hear our appetizers on Harambe the gorilla or where the presidential candidates stack up on the Second Amendment. And of course, you may have some friends who are supporters of homosexuality or some homosexual friends that you want to share this episode with. Hopefully it will be an encouragement and a challenge to them and to you as you try to get the gospel out there. As always, folks, thank you so much for listening to After the Sermon. I'm getting very excited about episode 50, where I'm going to detail some of the changes and the evolution that's happened to After the Sermon. I think you folks will enjoy that. Hopefully, it'll be a sort of whet your appetite for going back and listening to past episodes. But until then, we have another great guest coming up. We're going to be having the host of Hope for the Journey on to talk about drug addiction here in a little over a week. There won't be an episode this coming weekend. My birthday is June 23rd. I'll be celebrating 33 years, and I typically, right now, I have a day off on Thursday, so I typically do my recording then. So our next episode won't be until the following week. But as you're anticipating that, I would encourage you to check out episodes 45, 46, and 47, some fantastic interviews that we did, and dig up the archives and check out some of those, and check out any of the podcasts in the Theology Mix Podcast Network. They will bless you and encourage you and challenge you. Again, thanks for listening. Thanks for using up your hard drive space, your data, whatever it is. I appreciate your support. As always, folks, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week after the sermon.